discussion. I'd like to thank Mr. Harish Patel and the IK Foundation and the trustees for a wonderful reception and for arranging this event tonight. And I'm also grateful for the very opportunity that I have to be here in the UK. Western perceptions of Indian culture. It's a difficult topic, it's a big topic, and I was thinking of all kinds of reasons perhaps why somebody else would be better prepared to undertake this topic than myself. In one way, I think you are the people, those of you who are of Indian background, who have experienced Western culture, Western views of India. You are the ones who have had the personal experiences, your own life, your living, your family, your growing up, your education, in which I would think again and again and again, you have felt the impact of the West. And in all kinds of small and large ways, you have been told over and over again by what people say and what people do, this is what the West thinks of India. So I was thinking that I could actually stop there and then invite any of you to come up and say what you think about India and the West and leave it at that. Another disadvantage that I have tonight is that I'm very conscious of the rich culture of London, of the United Kingdom, of Oxford, of being here in Britain. I'm very aware of the long history of the interconnection between here and India. I'm very aware of all the ways in which the lives of people in Britain and in India have been connected for so many centuries now. And I'm an American. And I realize that, properly speaking, one could give an entire evening discussion of the United Kingdom and India, Britain and the Indian history, and it would have to be a whole different discussion and different lecture to talk about America and India. American experience of India, Indians in the UK, Indians in the United States. So you'll have to bear with me on my limited knowledge of life here and my limited knowledge of your experience as I share with you my ideas. I'm also aware that there are so many aspects that I could bring up in putting these remarks before you on Western perceptions of Indian culture. We live in a very complicated world in which one would want to talk about history, about culture, about food, about economics, about politics, about national affairs today, the business world, the healthcare world, immigration policy, race relations, all kinds of things that one would want to talk about to fill out this issue properly, because you don't simply have a Western perception of Indian culture. Perception happens in the midst of our lives. And all of these things need to be interconnected with economics and politics and history. But I think if I'm to finish, not by 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock, but before 9 o'clock, I need very much to narrow down what I have to say. And I'm also very eager to hear your questions, so I hope you come up with good questions, because I know that personally I get tired of hearing myself speak after a while. And I'm very eager to interact with you and understand your questions and what you think I should be talking about. So I've realized that I need to narrow down what I talk about and present to you tonight. And therefore, I've made several choices about limiting my topic. The first is, and it's given my own background as a professor of the religions of India and of theology, I'll be thinking mainly of the philosophical and religious perceptions of India. So out of all the things that I could say, I'll be focusing on religion and philosophy. Not that other topics are not important, but simply to narrow things down. And secondly, and this may be a less desirable choice, but you can bring up problems in your questions, I'm really thinking about Hinduism in the West, the Hindu traditions in the West. And I realize that that is not fair to the rich complexity of life in India, the rich complexity of you who have come here tonight. And I certainly don't want to give you the impression that I'm identifying the Hindu and the Indian, or thinking that everybody is somehow a Hindu. But I just think, given my expertise and the limitations of what I know and the limited time we have before us, that's what I'll be thinking of, is mainly Western perceptions of India, Western perceptions of the Hindu philosophical and religious tradition. And then hopefully in our discussion, we can open it up further and say, well, what about the Sikh tradition? Or what about the Jain tradition? Or what about Muslim population of India? And so on. And we can expand in different directions. I'm also, finally, in terms of one of the difficulties I'm dealing with, and I think, again, you know this already, Western perceptions of India have not always been flattering. It's not always been a positive thing to say everybody is polite, or everybody is kind, or everybody has the best things to say about Indian tradition and Indian culture. As you know, there's been a very mixed record of what Westerners have thought about India. Some of it is very positive, and I'll indicate some of that, but some of it is also very negative. And there have been real limitations and real criticisms about what people in the West have thought about India, how people have misunderstood the Indian traditions over many centuries. And I think my job tonight is not to flatter you, and not simply to say things that I think are positive, but simply more or less to put out for discussion some of the things that I've observed about how over history, over many generations, Westerners have thought about religion, philosophy, and Hindu religion and philosophy in the Indian context. And please don't take me as if I agree with the things that I'm saying. I think it's my job to say some of these things and put them out before us, but not to approve. My own personal experience of living in India, perhaps maybe about 5 years altogether, over the past 25 years, sometime in Nepal, actually in the far north, but also in Madras and Tamil Nadu in the south, has been extremely personally positive and extremely personally important. And there are thousands of ways in which I, as an individual person, have benefited and learned from India and from Indian people and from Hindu religious traditions. So I'm not really speaking for myself tonight when I talk about Western perceptions of Indian culture and religion, but trying to represent some key features of the tradition, for better or worse. And what I've decided to do to make my theme clearer as I put these points before you is somewhat fancifully, but hopefully clearly, deal with five kinds of attitudes or five kinds of caricatures that people have had of India over the generations. Five themes, perhaps, five stereotypes, perhaps, but ways that people have thought about India, looking at India and the Hindu traditions from the outside. And somewhat briefly, the five are these: Eternal India, Amazing India, Secret India, Learned India, and Free India. Eternal India, Amazing India, Secret India, Learned India, and Free India. And in my view, that these are five ways in which Western people, over the past 3,000 years perhaps, but also in very recent times, have in a sense complemented and honored the cultures of India and honored the Hindu traditions in particular. But there are also five different ways in which Westerners have had doubts about India and doubts about Indian culture. And so with each one as I take it up, I'll present something of the theme as I understand it, and then by reading some quotations from ancient and modern sources, give you a feel of kind of the ambivalence that people in the West have had about the Indian traditions. My first thing, Eternal India. India, the oldest place on earth. India, the beginning of religion, the beginning of culture. In some ways, this may not even be true, because we know about Egyptian culture, we know about the Mesopotamian civilizations, we know about people in different parts of Africa, we know about the complexity of talking about ancient history. But I think one of the things that I've seen and observed in writings about India over the years is people think of India as extremely old. People think of India as going back to the beginning. People think of China in this way too, of course. I think one of the things that stands out about India in people's minds is that there's something about India that is much older than the rest of the world. I'll read you a quotation from the well-known historian of the 20th century, Will Durant, in which he says something about how India, for him, evokes a sense of the beginning of the world, the beginning of history. And he's speaking as a Westerner and somebody who taught and lived in America, but he's speaking about all of us, I think. India was the motherland of our race, and Sanskrit the mother of Europe's languages. India was the mother of our philosophy. India was the mother, through the Arabs, of much of our mathematics. Indeed, through the Buddha, India was mother of the ideals embodied in Christianity. And through the village community, India is indeed the mother of self-government and democracy. Mother India is in many ways the mother of us all. I think there's a sense, and it's an enormous respect that I've run into in writings and also talking to individuals, that when we encounter India, we're encountering something as old as the human race. We're encountering the story of what it means to be human, and in ways it's a highly praiseworthy compliment to the people of India to say, somehow your culture, somehow your traditions have kept alive the earliest memories of who we are as human beings. I'll read you another quotation which puts it in a slightly different way but makes some of the same point. Romain Rolland was a great writer in the early part of the 20th century who wrote a famous biography of Sri Ramakrishna. He wrote many other books too, but his most famous book is about Ramakrishna. And in the introduction to the book, trying to persuade his Western readers why it's necessary to pay attention to India, why it's necessary, if we want to understand where we come from, to go back to our Indian history, our Indian roots, he says this: if there is one place on the face of the earth where all the dreams of living men have found a home, from the very earliest days when man began to dream of existence, it is India. The unique privilege of India has been that of an elder sister, a great elder sister, and even a mother, whose spiritual development, an autonomous flower continually growing through all the ages of all peoples, has never been interrupted. Another point that comes back: it's not just that India is ancient or India is timeless, but that India has memory of continuity. Indian culture has kept its connections. Mesopotamia died out. The ancient realm of the pharaohs died out. But India somehow has a connection all the way back to the beginning. For more than 30 centuries, Roland goes on, the tree of vision, with all its thousand branches and millions of twigs, has sprung from that torrid land, the burning womb of the gods. India, where even the gods themselves are born. It renews itself tirelessly, showing no signs of decay. All kinds of fruit ripen on its boughs at the same time. Side by side are found all kinds of gods, from the most savage to the highest. The formless god, the unnameable, the boundless one, always the one who is free. And of course, his book will go on to talk about Sri Ramakrishna, and basically to say that in the 19th century, in Ramakrishna, somehow there was a new awakening of the oldest religious memories of the world, and that there is a wisdom that goes back 3,000 or 4,000 years or more in India, suddenly can come alive, this unchanging, timeless wisdom that goes back to the very beginning of the world. Now, I think for the most part, to call India eternal, to call India timeless, to call India the oldest land that there is on the earth, with no disrespect for China and other places, is an enormous positive view that Americans and Europeans and Westerners in general have had for a very long time. It goes back to the earliest writings about India in Greek literature. But I think the other side of this, and this again is the negative side, because with each point I'll try to bring out the positive but also the negative, is that in some ways when Westerners look at India, they say, that's about where we came from. India is about the beginning. India is about the way things were when we were born. If you want to know where we're going, look to America. If you want to know about change and about the importance of history, look to the West. India stands for our memory. India stands for our past. The timeless wisdom of India that goes back to the earliest memories is all about starting points. Some people have even said, and I'll echo this in other comments that I say later, some people even say that it's actually a problem. Whereas other cultures change, whereas other cultures develop and grow and metamorphose into other forms over time, the thing about India is that it's now the same as it was 3,000 years ago. Now, of course, you know that that's not true. I know that that's not true. I know that India has changed a lot in the last 25 years, my experience of going there. So again, I'm not defending this view, but there's a sense in which to say it's wonderful that India is the oldest civilization. It's wonderful that India is timeless, but India can't change. India doesn't believe in change. India doesn't believe in history. India doesn't believe in progress. India will always be what India always was. Second point, that was timeless, eternal India. Amazing India. I think Westerners, again, I'm thinking of ancient times as far back as the Greeks. I'm thinking of the first missionaries, the Portuguese, who went to India in the 16th century. And I'm thinking of later generations. I'm thinking of people my age who went to India as college students. And I'm thinking of my students now in Boston, where I teach, who go to India today. Find India to be the most amazing country on the face of the earth. People are dazzled by India in a way that they're not dazzled by other countries that they may love and respect deeply. So again, it's not to say, you know, we disrespect Japan or disrespect China or disrespect Africa or whatever. But I think there's something about India in my experience and my reading of the literature and my talking to my students and so on, that India stands in a category that it simply dazzles people. Just getting off the plane in Delhi or Madras or Bombay, just driving in a taxi, just walking through the streets, trying to figure out how to buy something, just anything you do in India, I think often amazes people completely. And I think this is a long tradition that Westerners tend to think of India as a place that will constantly surprise you, a place that is endlessly fascinating, a place that is overwhelmingly unpredictable, a place that always has something new, and that you can never pin it down and say, now I understand Indian culture. Now I've figured out what India is about. But then people go back again and again and say, now I realize I'm only beginning. I mean, I personally have been studying India for, well, as I said, 25 years or more since I first went to India. And I think I'm realizing as I get older, the less I know, the deeper I need to go, the more there is to surprise me, to go back and to see things new again. There's a wonderful quotation from Mark Twain, so I will get a few Americans in this talk tonight. Mark Twain visited India in the 1890s, I think it was, and he wrote a wonderful book about his trip around the world. But one of his most famous quotations and most famous quotations about India is the following, and I think he captures what a lot of people still feel when they hear the word India, when they see a picture of India. And he's just been talking about his time in Bombay, getting off the ship, taking the train, being in Bombay, beginning to explore the city. This is indeed India, the land of dreams and romance, of fabulous wealth and fabulous poverty, of splendor and rags, of palaces and hovels, of famine and pestilence, of gods and giants and Aladdin lamps, of tigers and elephants, of cobra and jungle, the good and the bad, the amazing, the natural, the civilized, the ancient. A country of 100 nations and 100 tongues, of 1,000 religions and 2 million gods, cradle of the human race, birthplace of human speech, mother of history, grandmother of legend, great-grandmother of tradition, whose yesterdays bear date with the moldering antiquities of the nations of the world. again, as in my first point, what is the most ancient memories of anywhere else is just yesterday in India. Whose yesterday's the one sole nation under the sun that is endowed with perishable interest for alien prince and alien peasant, for lettered and ignorant, for wise and fool, for rich and poor, for bond and free, the one land that all people desire to see, and having seen once, by even a glimpse, would not give that glimpse for the shows of all the rest of the globe combined. Now, it's a pretty outrageous thing to say, but I think in some ways it's true for those who have been to India and experienced that somehow you can go elsewhere, you can travel in Europe, you can come to the UK, you can do these different things, you can go to America if you haven't been to America. But there's something about India that once you've been there, you want to go back. Once you've been there, you think of it again and again and again. And again, while you can think of 1,000 exceptions and 1,000 views that other people may have, I think that captures a very important part of what people in the West have thought. The most amazing, most diverse, most unpredictable, most wonderful place on the face of the earth. This is also true, and I won't read you examples, but I'll mention it to you. Some of the very oldest Western perceptions we have of India are from the Greek scholar Megasthenes. Megasthenes was an ambassador from one of the Syrian courts to India in about the 3rd century BC. We don't know a lot about him. In fact, his major work about India was lost, and we only have fragments of it in other people's work. But apparently he lived in India for a few years, and then he wrote back home and published a book, at least as they published 2,500 years ago, in Greek about his impressions of India. And I think it sort of captures a bit of what people have done with India ever since, the way he describes and kind of puts together his views of Indian culture. And I was just reading, again, a series of selections from his writings this past week and thinking of what I might say to you tonight. And literally almost in one kind of section, you can turn the pages from section to section of the excerpts from Megasthenes' writings. He first talks about the gold-digging ants. And apparently in ancient times there was a rumor that in ancient India there were these fabulous ants whose entire specialty in life was to look for gold. And that if only you could get to India where these ants were, instead of seeing by the ant holes simply an anthill of dirt, you would see these mounds of gold. Because unlike anywhere else in the world, there were these gold-digging ants, and they were simply there, and the gold was simply there to take. And if only you could get to India, all of this would be yours. He also goes on to talk about the odd people who live in India. And he talks about people who are extremely tall and extremely short. He talks about people who begin with gray hair and white hair when they're young, and their hair gets dark, and they look younger as they get older. This was before beauty surgery and so on. He talks also about a strange group of people who have no mouths. And all they can do is breathe through their nostrils. And apparently that the only way they get nourishment is by breathing flowers and breathing vegetables and so on. So they constantly all day long, since they can't eat, they have to be breathing things. And when they go traveling, they bring things with strong smells with them so they can constantly get the odors so as to keep their bodies going. And he reports all of this with a totally straight face. These are things that go on in India. Then he goes on to talk about the 7 castes, not the 4, but the 7, and he describes in great detail business, agriculture, trade, how cities work, how villages work, the artisans, the people who work in the fields, the Brahmin teachers, and he describes all of this on the same level as talking about the gold-digging ants and the men who have no mouths. And it's almost as if he's saying, well, elsewhere in the world, you'd say, well, you can't have all these things. I mean, are we talking fairy tales or are we talking reality? But he seems, without a worry, is able to go from the most fantastic details you can imagine to trying to describe the social structures of India when he was there. And then he goes on to talk, finally, in the sections I was reading, about Indian wise men. He actually mentioned some Indian wise women, too. He said, although there aren't many, that their husbands let them read the books. But he says there are a few. But in mainly talking about the men, In some ways, he describes the life of a sannyasi. And he talks about these people who live in the forest, and they devote their lives entirely to meditation, and they spend their times in prayer, and they eat very little, and they wear very little, and they have the simplest lives possible, and they're totally dedicated to wisdom. And it seems that when he says this about them, he's really saying, what can we hope for in Greece? We can hope for this wisdom, that we can be like these men in India who devote their lives entirely to the life of wisdom. And that, of course, is an ancient and great theme in the Western view also. But my point with this is simply to say that for Megasthenes, and I think for generations of Westerners after that, there's an enormous expectation and toleration that India is everything you can imagine, from the most bizarre to the most wonderful, from the most imaginative to the most unimaginable. And I think there's sort of a sense that with other countries you'd say, well, why don't you get your act together, and why don't you be this, or why don't you be that? But that India somehow has the room and the space to have all of these things intertwined with one another. And so when you study India, you can study very detailed versions of Sanskrit grammar, or you can do Nyaya logic, or you can do scientific treatises. And you can do it very, very seriously. And then suddenly you get the most amazing story in the world about one of the gods or goddesses doing this or that, or people doing the most exotic asceticism you can possibly imagine. And with a straight face, you just take it and say, oh yes, that's true, that's true too, that's true too, that's true too. And I think there's a sense in which that tolerance is basically a very positive thing. That India is not only very old, India is very broad and very wide and very generous. And there is really room for everything in India. But I think Westerners have also wondered, and this is sort of the negative side of the second point about amazing India, is that India doesn't know when to stop. Indians don't know when to draw the line and say, that's simply too weird, that's simply too bizarre. Other cultures will say, no, wait a minute, you simply can't live that way. You can't do this, you can't do that. There are boundaries, that's shameful. That doesn't make any sense. But that somehow the Indian way of being is to say, you can be the most rational or the most irrational, the most normal, the most abnormal, all of that is what we expect. And Westerners sort of say, well, that's the way Indians are. There's room for everything. And therefore, there's no judgment to say, this is not acceptable. There's no point at which people will stand up and say, stop. This is not acceptable for our culture. But everything fits in, so everything can be done. My own research over the years, my introducer mentioned that I'm a Jesuit priest. I'm a Catholic priest. I belong to the Society of Jesus, so we have a long history connection with India back to St. Francis Xavier, who went to India in 1542. And I think there's a long tradition religiously of saying that India also is a very imaginative place, even to the extreme of being unimaginable. And I've found in reading the missionary literature that one of the things that they couldn't understand at all about India was idolatry. And what they couldn't understand are these striking and overwhelmingly striking images of gods that you find in temples, and that, as you know better than I, there are different styles of images of the divine figures in different parts of India, very austere in Sri Vaishnava tech in temples in the south, very colorful in different parts of the north, thousands of different ways of portraying Ganesha, let's say, very different ways of portraying different goddesses, some of them very bloody with necklaces of skulls and so on. And I think what the missionaries objected to, partially they were Christian missionaries and said, well, you shouldn't do these things, but partially what they objected to was to say, this couldn't possibly be what God is like. You have such an imagination, and you have such a tolerance, an amazing way of thinking about everything, that suddenly God can look like an elephant, or suddenly God can have four arms, or suddenly God can have 10 heads, or suddenly God can be wearing a necklace of skulls, or suddenly God can have a tongue hanging out, licking blood, or suddenly one God can be standing on top of another. And the missionaries, back to Francis Xavier, said, no, this is not acceptable, this is too much. We should be much more rational in thinking about God. We should limit our ways of imagining who God is. And I think part of it, again, was just their own bias and their own starting points. But a lot of it also was to say, again, culturally, personally, religiously, India pushes you off the edge. India doesn't make sense to the Western mind. India is wonderful, but when you try to imagine all of it at once, either culturally or religiously, it pushes you too far. And I think sometimes the objection or the pondering, the problem that people in the West have had about the Hindu religious traditions is that they can't imagine how all of this fits together. On one level, they'll admire the fact there's room for everybody. You can be as you are. But on another level, this is unimaginable. I can't imagine a religion or a God that looks in this way. I think that's why, just a footnote to that, why many people in the West, when they start seriously studying another religion, always start with Buddhism. Because I think Buddhism, again, this is not necessarily historical, but it may be the impression people have, is that Buddhism is clear, Buddhism is simple. You go to a Buddhist temple, it's empty. You learn to sit and meditate, it's very quiet. And people can deal with this and say, what I need is quiet in my life. What I need is to calm down. What I need is to be low-key. But if you go to India, you open up, and suddenly everything comes alive for you. And I think a lot of Westerners simply don't get it, and they back off in saying, India is amazing, but India is bizarre. Secret India, my third point. I think there's another pattern about India that I've noticed in people's writings and people's thinking, is that whereas most cultures, they basically say what they think, and again, we're in the UK, and I'm from America, and these are deeply kind of involved in the Christian tradition, in which there's a great kind of sense of putting forward and saying everything you think. It's a religious attitude. Go forth and preach the gospel. Make sure everybody knows what you're talking about. But on another level, it's also everything that you believe should sort of be out there for everybody to see. People say this about Americans all the time. Americans sort of run up to you and say hello like they're your best friend without even waiting a day or two to get to know you. Everything should be up front. Everything should be out on the table. You should be able to say everything to people. But I found in the study of India, in the study of Western views of India, is that people in the West believe that Indians keep secrets. And that much of the wisdom of India is secret wisdom. And that much of the wisdom of India is basically not going to be revealed to you for a very, very long time. So it's not enough to say, would you just give me your sacred book? I'd like to read and I'd like to know what you people believe. Or would you just show me this inner part of your temple? Or would you just explain to me what you're doing? There's a strong sense, and it goes back to when the first scholars started reading the Upanishads and translating the Upanishads into Western languages. But also when people realize that, you know, you have to study yoga, you need to be with a yogic teacher, and that it's so hard to find the right kind of teacher, is that all of this takes a very long time because most of it is not going to be revealed to you when you first come. Most of it is there, low-key, underground, and most people will not hear it or be told it for a very long time. I know stories from the Upanishads. I've been giving lectures at Oxford on the Upanishads this term. And there are so many stories in the oldest Upanishads, like the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which talk about teachers and the Chandogya. Teachers who basically say to your students, oh, sure, you want to learn from me? That's very good. Wait. Come back in a few years. Come back in 12 years, and maybe I'll teach you then. Come back in 12 years, we'll come back in 24 years. I'll see if you're still interested. And I think people sort of take this for granted, that it's very difficult to get inside because this is sort of this precious core that you shouldn't reveal to people until they're ready for it. And I think in some ways it's a great compliment to Indian culture to say India is sensible enough about its sacred truth that it doesn't sort of throw it out into the crowd. It doesn't say, let's publish it and let's put it out there for everybody at once. But when you are ready for it, you can take another step. And when you're more ready, you can take a second step. And that maybe by the end of this lifetime, or your next lifetime, or your third lifetime, you can make your way closer to the center. And I think in a way, people in the West respect this by saying, yes, that makes a lot of sense. There's a wonderful quotation that I'll read to you on this theme from Paul Brunton. Paul Brunton was a Westerner who went to India in the 1920s. And he wrote a book called Search in Secret India. which sort of gives away his theme. But he spent a couple of years in India in the late 1920s, going around India looking for sadhus and yogis and gurus and munis living by themselves in the jungle and so on, because he wanted to get at the real India. He wanted to find the people who really represented that timeless India that goes back to the beginning. And this, and he's trying in the introduction to convince people in the West that they should take all of this very seriously. And he makes a series of contrasts first, and he talks about, okay, you go to India, and this is 1920s, and you talk to the British man on duty in the train station or something, and you ask him where the sadhu lives, and he looks at you like he doesn't know what you're talking about and says there are no sadhus, because he's been there 12 years and he's never noticed people living in the jungle. Or where can I go to practice yoga? And he said, well, they don't do yoga anymore. They did that thousands of years ago. So he makes all these comments about how people can live in India, the colonial rulers, for a long time and never pay any attention because it's so low-key and so off to the side. But then he goes on to say this. And again, this is a double edge to it. So part of this is not very flattering, but I'll read it to you anyway. I shall not take the trouble to deny that the West has little to learn from India today. But I do insist that we have much to learn from Indian sages of the past and from the secret few who continue to live today. I assert this unhesitatingly and definitely. Now, many white tourists, and he calls them white tourists, who do India and see the chief cities and historical sites and then go off with disgust at the backward civilization of India, these white tourists are doubtlessly justified in their repugnance at modern-day India. So again, apologies, this is not me speaking. But a wiser kind of tourist will arise one day who will seek out not the crumbling ruins of useless temples or the marbled palaces of dissipated kings long dead, but the secret sages who can reveal a wisdom untaught even in our greatest universities. And I think that captures, again, another aspect of what people think about India. There is something there. There is a secret. There is a mystery. There is a truth that Oxford University and Harvard University don't have a clue about. There is something there deep in the culture, hidden away in the mind of the yogi or the sadhu, that is most precious, most wonderful, and if you go, you may miss it entirely. But it's there waiting for the few who will take it seriously. And again, he got on a little more to talk about the material degeneration, the mental flabbiness of Indians today. This is 1920s. He says, but if you can only bear this and pay attention more closely, you will find wonderful things. Grant that India has been sleeping for many centuries. Grant that today in India there are many peasants who suffer the same illiteracy, share the same outlook, blended of superstition and kindergarten religion, as did English peasants in the 14th century. So India in the 1920s measures up to England in the 14th century. Granted that all of this is true, and granted that the Brahmin pundits in the native centers of learning waste their time splitting hairs and drawing metaphysical distinctions as subtly as did our medieval scholastics. That's another sub-theme that I can only point to. Many of the scholars and visitors who went to India in the 18th, 19th, 20th century often compared India to medieval Europe. They didn't have a high opinion of medieval Europe. They called it the Dark Ages. And they said, India is so much like the Dark Ages. India is like the Catholic teachers, the great Catholics who founded Oxford and so forth. And saying that India has this punditry in the bad sense. And it's just like what we had in medieval scholasticism. So he says, grant all of this, and you don't like these things, and they're no good, and it's very boring, and so on. But he says, and this is the point, but pay attention. There still remains a small but priceless residue of culture classified under the term yoga, which offers to mankind a wisdom more valuable in their own way than anything offered by Western science. This wisdom can bring our bodies nearer to the healthy condition which nature intended them to possess. This wisdom can bestow on modern civilization what it needs most, a flawless serenity of mind It can open a way to enduring treasures of the Spirit for those who are willing to work for them. I admit that the great wisdom can hardly be seen in India today. It seems to belong to her past. But I warn you that this guarded wisdom, this guarded yoga of the tradition, flourishes in certain secret places in India that can still be found. Now again, you are Indian. Most of you are Indian. Most of you are of Indian background, and I'm sure you've all been there or are born there many times. And you can say, well, what is he talking about, this secret India? What kind of stories is he making up? But I think, again, the point is, in Western views of India, that on the one side, it's a wonderful compliment to say that whereas other cultures lose their wisdom and forget their tradition and scatter things out without worrying who understands them or not, India has these special core sacred secrets and has kept them alive for thousands of years, passing them down from guru to disciple, from yogi teacher to disciple, the wisdom that has been recited for generations. And if only you are patient enough, you will find it. And I know innumerable people who have gone to India looking for that wisdom. Now, the downside of this, of course, is the Paul Brunton attitude. You know, modern India is too big, it's too dirty, it's too complicated. People don't know the stuff, they don't know their tradition. Oh, you have a miserable time when you go to India. But if you can put up with India, you will find the sacred wisdom. There's this kind of mixed attitude. The beauties of the greatest tradition in the world, and then you have to put up with being in India. And it's a real insult in a way. But it's a mixed one saying, oh, it's so awful, but there's this thing that's worth putting up with everything. Now, I think the question, though, that it raises, that perhaps is more philosophical about it, is whether or not this perception kind of really says that there are two Indias, not one. And on the one hand, there's this sacred wisdom that goes back to the beginning, and that is worth it more than anything in the world. And then there's the large India that somehow has become cut off from that. There's the India of the public streets. There's the India of the big ghettos, the slums. There's the India of the enormous crowds. There's the India of chaos and confusion. And that's sort of the India of the surface. And separate from that is this kind of secret India that is much more wonderful. And it's like these two worlds. Westerners, when they see India, they see overwhelming crowds and poverty and confusion and so on. And then suddenly they turn their eyes and say, oh, but there's this precious jewel, the most wonderful jewel in the world. If only we could have that and not that. Learned India. Learned India, wise India, intellectual India, pundit India, perhaps the most verbally articulate, the most educated place in the world, the longest academic and scholarly traditions that we know of on the face of the earth that are unbroken and continuing. I think this is another strand, my fourth strand, and another way of thinking about the Indian traditions, is that I think for a very long time, back to Megasthenes, I mentioned him among the Greeks, but even when the first Jesuits, Francis Xavier and his immediate successors, got to India, and then when the great British scholars came to India in the 18th, 19th century, is being genuinely, deeply impressed by just how learned India is, and just by how amazingly erudite, and how many sophisticated systems of thought have been worked out over the generations. And here, certainly, I can easily expand it and say it's not just Hindu, it's also the Buddhist traditions, and the Jain traditions, and the Sikh traditions, and all the other local traditions of India. But beginning to begin to understand and tap into the enormous wisdom of which we have over 3,000 years of records in history, and the accumulation in just sense over the centuries of how much we're only, even now in the 21st century, just beginning to understand that learning and that tradition. At Oxford, there are scholars, I think, who drive themselves crazy, even today, by realizing how many books published of Sanskrit literature or Tamil literature or other literatures there are that they have not yet read. And then for every book that has been published of a Sanskrit or other text, how many palm leaf manuscripts exist that have not even been cataloged yet, have not yet been put into catalogs, have not yet been published, much less translated. And I think Westerners are genuinely, once they get to know a little bit about India, are willing to concede that it's really impossible. Everybody thinks, well, China maybe, but really thinks of India as one of the most learned places in the world, if not the most learned. And you can talk about, you know, great universities in the West, Oxford or Paris or Harvard or Columbia in New York, whatever. You can think of these great places and centers of learning, but what, they're 1,000 years old at most, the oldest of them. And the sense is, with my Upanishads lecture today, being able to talk about stories and records and histories that go back well over 3,000 years, the origins of them. And I think Westerners genuinely will back off and say, we can't compare. There's enormous learning here. It's wonderful. It's the most impressive thing we know of. I'll just read you a couple of quotations that bring this point home. Schopenhauer, Arthur Schopenhauer, was one of the great German philosophers of the 18th and 19th century period, when you have this great flourishing of German thought. And he was quite insistent that despite the wonders of the Greeks and the wonders of European literature and the great books of Western philosophy, it was India that he needed to go back to intellectually again and again to understand. And this is what he says, just a simple quote, a couple of simple quotes. From every sentence of the Upanishads, ideas original and sublime arise. The entirety of the Upanishads is pervaded by a high, holy, and earnest spirit. In the world, there is no study except the study of the Upanishads that is so beneficial, so elevating. It has been the solace of my life and will be the solace of my death. Of all the learning, a very learned man, he says, India, the Upanishadic tradition, that's it. That's the best. He also said, I believe that the influence of Sanskrit literature will penetrate not less deeply than did the Greek literature in Europe up until this time. And so what the Greeks did in shaping European identity and European culture for so many millennia, that in the future, it would be Indian literature that would shape the world in which we live. And I think he spoke for other scholars too, the ones who did the first translations of the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata, some of the great Oxford scholars, Wilson and Monier Williams and others, who you can see their pictures and statues all around Oxford, the India Institute Library and so on, dedicated to the fact that there is an endless store of wisdom in India, intellectually on the cutting edge, that we need to understand and to take seriously. Max Müller, the great scholar, German scholar who lived at Oxford for a good part of his life and published that great series, The Sacred Books of the East, he likewise had this wonderful understanding of India. And he said this, if I were to look out over the whole world to find out the country most richly endowed with all the wealth, power, and beauty that nature can bestow, in some parts, paradise on earth, I should have to point only to India. If I were asked under what sky the human mind has most fully developed the choicest gifts, has most fully pondered on the greatest problems, and has found solution to some of them that deserve the attention even those who have spent their lives studying Plato and Kant, I should have to point to India. And if I were to ask myself from what literature we here in Europe, we who have studied almost exclusively the thought of the Greeks and the Romans, and of one Semitic race, the Jewish, if I have asked ourselves from what literature we may draw that corrective which is most wanted in order to make our inner life more truly human, a life that is not only for this life here and now, but a transfigured and eternal life, again, I can appoint only to India. So one of the great scholars of the 19th century says, it's Indian learning, it's Indian tradition. And I think that is extremely positive, extremely flattering, and I think for anyone interested in intellectual history, that's what we need to think. But I think there's also another tendency in Western thought, and this is sort of the downside of the sense of learned India or wise India, in which people will say about India, oh, isn't that nice? And they'll say to me, you're studying Sanskrit. Oh, isn't that nice? Why don't you do something useful? You're studying all those ancient books, but that's all so old. Yes, you could spend your life, and if you believed in reincarnation, you could spend several lifetimes over doing those palm leaf manuscripts. But it's all out of date. It's ancient wisdom. Remember, India is timeless. India never changes. Nothing new in India. So you're just looking back into the interminable past. You're finding out where things were. It's an endless wisdom, but come on, get with it. We're in the 21st century. find something new, look at progressive European Western thought, do technology, you'll find something much better. So there's this kind of split attitude. It's the most wonderful wisdom in the world, but it's so old, it's so out of date. One of the most scandalous and famous versions of this was Lord Macaulay, who was one of the great rulers, he was an administrator in India in the 1830s. And Macaulay was there when the famous debate was going on about what kind of Indian educational system to have. And the British presumed that, you know, we're here, we're going to save the Indians from themselves, we're going to set up everything nicely, so what can we do to improve the Indians while we're here? And we need to improve their educational system and put everything in order. And the debate was whether the British should support traditional centers of learning, both in Muslim and Hindu tradition, so Urdu, Arabic learning centers, Sanskrit learning centers, or should impose English-style education. And there was a debate back and forth, and you get all these people who were at Oxford saying, oh, Sanskrit's the most wonderful literature in the world and all that, we should definitely pay teachers to teach Sanskrit and so on, and keep all of this going. And Macaulay, who was only there for 4 years, and apparently never learned Sanskrit, but he was a very smart man, so he knew everything after a couple of years there. He wrote a famous minute on Indian education in 1836, and he basically apparently won the day. Now, I'm not a historian, but the sources I was reading, they basically won the day by persuading people to go for English educational system and not for Sanskrit and Islamic education. And they basically said, listen, let's cut off their money and not really pay for them. And we can have, all right, we'll have one school in Benares and one in Delhi, and that'll take care of them. But after a few generations, they'll dry up and the whole thing will just stop. And everybody will be studying English literature instead. So he's very confident that this would happen by 1850 or so. But he said, there's several amazingly quotable quotes from his minute on education. He says this, all right, there are many people who claim that there's wonderful things in Arabic and Sanskrit literature. And they said, I've talked to some of them and I know these distinguished scholars who make these claims all the time. And I'm quite ready to think that this is what the Indians think about themselves. And this is what the scholars think about the Indians. But I personally, I have never found one among them who could deny that a single shelf of a good European library was worth the whole native literature of India and Arabia. So just one shelf of European library is worth more than all of that of the East. The intrinsic superiority of the Western literature is indeed fully admitted by any member of this committee who understands what education is about. It's so clear that I don't even have to argue the point. And then he goes on to talk about, all right, there may be dispute, and some people think that maybe the Indians aren't the best on science or mathematics, but they're pretty good at poetry. And it's supposed to be this fellow Kalidasa, who's supposed to be something like Shakespeare. And that's what they say, and that's what they tell me, so we should be doing Indian literature, at least, Indian poetry in school. But he says this, he makes his point again. It is, I believe, no exaggeration to say that all the historical information that has been connected from all the books written in the Sanskrit language and all the poetry written by all the poets of India is less valuable than what may be found in the most paltry abridgments used at preparatory schools in England. So what a schoolboy gets in a public school is worth more than the entirety of whatever these people are talking about they get from India. But then more seriously, he goes on finally, and I think we shouldn't dismiss entirely what he's saying, because his final point is to say, look, all right, so the Indians have this tradition, they have their Sanskrit, they have their Arabic, they have all this other stuff. It's not worth anything like what we have, and the Indians really want to learn Shakespeare, and the Indians really want to do Keats and other great poets of the Western world, because that's really where their future is. And they know this themselves. He points out in one part of the letter, look, any Indian who's bright and has a future is going to drop Sanskrit at the drop of a hat and run off and learn British stuff because they know this is the way of the future and they'll get ahead this way. But he also goes on to say the problem with the Indian texts and all that is that they're actually not true. And so you have this lovely literature and lovely philosophy and lovely religious texts, but none of it makes any sense. And if you think about it really basically, you'll realize that it's part of the fantastic and fabulous mind of India. It's very learned, very erudite. You can spend your life reading Sanskrit and all that. But for the 19th and 20th century and beyond, we have to move in a new direction. So we're really going to do the Indians a favor by having English-style education. And I think in a way, not to push the point any further, it represents a kind of attitude that the West has had toward India. There's the positive side, Max Müller, Schopenhauer, and so on, saying the most wonderful, the deepest learning that we can find in the world. And Macaulay and others like him coming along and saying, but wait a minute, it's the past. There are a lot of words, but it doesn't add up to very much. And again, I know from my own experience, people saying, why do you bother your time reading that stuff? Why don't you do something useful like reading Western literature? And finally, number five, and my time is almost up, so I'll bring things to a conclusion. Free India, my fifth point. And what I really mean by free India is India a land where people can be entirely free, a land of individualists, a land where people are not bound by other people's rules, a land where you can be yourself and you can be the most conformist to your family traditions or your caste practices, or you can do something totally out of line. You can create your own path. You can go around dressed as a Maharaja, you can go around naked. You can read everything, you can read nothing. You can become the wealthiest man in the country, you can live as a beggar on the street. There's a strong sense, I think, in the West, and it's sort of been puzzling, but I think people are beginning to understand it. Again, some of this you would know better than I, is that it's not an accident that India is a democracy. It's not an accident that whereas democracy has failed in many of the, in the post-colonial world in so many countries, that there's something very basic about Indian culture and Indian attitudes and Indian views of the world that is basically open to the freedom of the individual. And that there's a strong sense that even though we tend to talk of democracy in terms of the Greeks, and the Enlightenment, and the French Revolution, and the American Revolution, and John Locke's treatises, and so on, Thomas Jefferson, and so on, there's a recognition that many people, I think, are beginning to have, and historians and scholars have known it for much longer, that there is a very, very strong sense of the individual, of the self in the Indian tradition that lends itself very well to democracy. And that there's no way in the Indian tradition that the individual will be simply oppressed by the majority. But there's always room for the exception. There's no way to force everybody to do the same thing. There are many contrasts in the tradition, and it goes all the way back to Hegel in the 18th century, contrasting and comparing India and China. And this is not a lecture about China, and I don't want to be unfair to the traditions of China, which are obviously marvelous and deserve our attention. But Hegel, I think, echoed a point that many Westerners have felt, is that when you look at China, you get this image, and he'd never been to China, but it's sort of confirmed by later imagination that people have. When you look at China, you imagine an endless number of people doing the same thing. Again, it's probably not fair and not true, but people dressed alike, eating alike, traveling alike, thousands of people with the same of everything. And Hegel, in his treatise about the philosophy of history, says the real problem that China runs into is that it's easy to have an emperor. And the emperor can be in charge, and the emperor can put everything in order, and a billion people will do exactly what the emperor says. That's China's problem. But Hegel says it's absolutely unimaginable to think about India in that way. India is the least likely country in the world to have an absolute dictatorship. And then I think Hegel was representing what other people were thinking in his time, and ideas that would come up in later times as well, that the main thing about India is that nobody quite looks like anybody else. And nobody quite dresses like anybody else. And nobody's religious practice is quite like anybody else's. And nobody's family tradition of the guru is quite like somebody else's family tradition of the guru. And if you try to get everybody going in one direction, it's sort of, people have said at times, it's like trying to herd cats. You have 100 cats and you try to get them all to go in one direction, and everybody goes off in different directions. Is that that's the way Hegel, in his own very Germanic, very lofty philosophical language, was saying that the thing about India is that everybody is spreading out in all directions, doing their own thing. And he was both kind of amazed at this, and marveled at it, and marveled at the sense of the freedom of the individual. And he declared that India was free in a way that he thought 2 centuries ago China would never be free. But he also said, what this really means is that India is doomed to a life of chaos, and that you'll never get India organized to progress and modernize itself properly, because Indians have no sense of cooperation. And again, this is not my view, this is what he's saying 2 centuries ago, is that Indians do 1,000 different things in 1,000 different ways, and every individual is a world unto himself or herself. And each person is sort of Indra, king of the gods. And everybody stands for his own destiny and his own future, her own way of doing things. And that's the way he says it is, and so India constantly, he claimed, will fall into chaos. Because there'll never be a time when you can get Indians to say, well, it's not just about myself or my reality, but it's about our weaving our destinies together. And again, I think, you know, the point is the Western perceptions of India. And I think many people, again, when they think of going to China, they're afraid of being followed by the secret police or something. And they'll be afraid of kind of being lost in this regimented society. But if they go to India, they're afraid of just getting lost. And they'll never find their way from the airport to the hotel. And they'll never figure out how to get to the restaurant. And they'll never figure out what language are we speaking today. So it's just as a sense of, it's a long tradition of thinking that India is so free, it's entirely unpredictable. I'll just read you one quote from Mark Twain again, my friend Mark Twain, from his book about India. And at this point, he's been talking again about how wonderful, and he seemed genuinely to enjoy India. He had a great sense of humor, and he actually found India quite amusing. And he enjoyed the people, enjoyed the culture, and enjoyed his time there. But toward the end of his reflection on India, he says this: India had the start of the whole world in the beginning of things. Again, timeless, beginningless India. India always first. India had the start of the whole world in the beginning of things. She had the first civilization, the first accumulation of material wealth. She was populous with deep thinkers and subtle intellects. She had mines, she had woods, she had fruitful soil. It would seem as if she should have kept the lead and should be today not the meek dependent of an alien master, but the mistress of the entire world. Given India's potential, India should be the number one nation. And delivering law and command to every tribe and nation in the world. But in truth, there was never any possibility of such supremacy for India. If there had been but one India and one language, that might have been possible. But in fact, there were 80 Indias and 80 languages. And where there are 80 languages and 80 nations and hundreds of governments, fighting and quarreling must be the common business of life. Unity of purpose and policy are impossible. Out of such elements of supremacy in the world, out of such elements, supremacy in the world can never come. Even the caste system itself could have had the defeating effect of a multiplicity of tongues, no doubt. For caste separates a people into layers and layers and still other layers that have no community of feeling with one another. Everybody is in a different caste. And in such a condition of things, patriotism could never grow, and the country could never go in one direction at the same time. And that's Mark Twain. He's not the greatest philosopher in history, but I think he's tapping into, again, what people in the West think about India. My time is basically run out, so I'll just make a couple of comments to conclude. One would be even about a modern figure like Gandhi. And my, you know, if we're talking about Western perceptions of India, when it comes to the 20th century, for many Westerners, India is Gandhi, Gandhi is India. Now, I know that's not true for many Indian people, but for many people in the West, and particularly since the movie came out, and Ben Kingsley was there, and it was just the most popular movie, and as you know, Gandhi was one of the most popular people of the 20th century in all the voting lists and so on. There's a strong sense that somehow there is the man who could, one individual person who was so free and so self-possessed, he could defeat the British Empire. And that's what India is about, is allowing the individual to be the individual to the point where no one can ever come. But I think there's also another feeling, and sometimes we pick this up from Indians too, is that Gandhi was just Gandhi. And Gandhi was so much an individual that you can't expect the rest of us to act like Gandhi. That basically we can honor Mahatmaji, and we can reverence him as this wonderful man, but that was him and I'm me. And there's not a great carryover from Gandhiji to me, because he's an individual and I'm an individual. And you sort of get this split between the wonderful person and what each other Indian person is to do. And so it's the sense that we're so free that we needn't even imitate the best among us. To conclude, and very briefly, I've given you five examples. I've talked about five different ways of thinking about Indian culture, five different sets of Western perceptions of India, and I think you probably have 1,000 ways in your mind of thinking of other things I should have said, I could have said, other people I could have quoted, aspects I didn't bring out. I agree with you entirely. There were lots of things I didn't say. I also agree that I've been dealing mainly with history, mainly with the past, the 19th, 20th century and earlier times. And I think we all know things are changing. The world is changing, India is changing, the West is changing, and you can't even properly today talk about the West and India. I mean, here we are in the West, in the strong Indian community. And now to be a Westerner is also to be an Indian. To be an Indian is not simply to be, or to be a Hindu is not simply to be an Indian, but it's also to be an American or British or French or whatever. And that these things are crossing and we can no longer say India here and the West there as we did in the past. And I think a lot of these things I've said basically probably tell us more about the West than they do about India. You know, if I have a strong sense of what's right about you and what's wrong about you, it's often I'm just sort of self-satisfying my own views of things as an individual. But a lot of what the West has said about India is really the West thinking about the West. And we end up saying things about you that make us look very bad. And that's the way things are. But I think it would be bad if we went away from tonight where you thought, all right, that's what the West thinks, now we can forget it. But I think when people criticize us, or when people look at us ambivalently, or when people have divided attitudes toward us, they do often teach us something about ourselves. So for instance, if India is timeless, if India is ancient, do you really believe that change is good? Do you really believe that history matters? Do you really believe that progress is part of India's future? If I say that India is amazing, do you have any standard for the bizarre? Are the things that you're willing to say as an Indian community, this is simply too bizarre for us? These are things that should not be done. We think that certain things should be ruled out. We can be imaginative and creative, but we have boundaries. Not everything goes. Or if I go on to say, well, India also is secret. India has this secret tradition of wisdom that never dies out. Isn't it true that there may be kind of a divide, even perhaps in the Indian community in the UK, between spiritual values over here and material values over here? You know, we honor the gurus, we honor the swamis, we honor the sadhus, we admire yoga, and then we go out and live totally secular lives. Isn't that possible? Don't you know people like that? And isn't there something to the idea that secret wisdom in public life should be brought together? Do you believe, with Muller and people like that, that Indian wisdom is so important that we should spend our lives learning the Sanskrit classics, learning Tamil literature, Bengali literature, Marathi literature, and so on, spending our lives educating and transmitting it to our children? Or do you believe with Lord Macaulay that in fact that's the past, let's admire it and not read it? You know, it's nice to have a Sanskrit tradition, but don't expect me to know anything about it. And then finally, when it comes to being free, isn't there the sense that it's wonderful to be an individual? But again, how much is it possible to say, we have moral standards, we have values, we agree on the following things. We believe that the future of India should have a coherent pattern. We are going to change democracy in the UK by communicating a set of coherent values. Do you believe that, or do you believe that everybody's really out there on their own? So those are some concluding questions, and I have no answers to my questions, but I hope that what I've said to you is somewhat helpful. Thank you.